Welcome, friends. Welcome back to ArtCast. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you from the North American Architect Forum here in Vail, Colorado, at the lovely Vail Cascade Resort and Spa. Had to throw that in. But we're thinking about architecture questions here today, and one of the most interesting questions is, who are you? And what are you allowed to do anyway? Those are questions of authentication and authorization, and they relate to some of the many challenges of identity. And on this episode, we are joined by Beth Patton, who is talking about the challenges of identity and overcoming them here with the architects at the Architect Forum. So let's tune in, listen to Beth, and learn something about how we can solve these identity challenges. Let's give it up for Beth Patton. But this is Ron Jacobs, and I am here at the Vail Cascade Resort, high in the mountains of Colorado. I think it's way high because I am getting really dried out here in this very thin air. And I'm joined by Beth Patton. Now, Beth, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What you do?
I'm from Chicago, and I work in the National Architecture Team.
Yeah.
Out of Redmond, and I am an infrastructure technology advisor. And what we do is we work with some top accounts in specialized industry verticals. I work with the manufacturing and healthcare and life sciences verticals. Mm-hmm. So I work with like the automotives. I work with pharmaceutical companies and the insurers like Cigna and United Healthcare.
Okay, so as an infrastructure advisor, what does that mean? You're kind of telling them, "Hey, you ought to put your server over there."
Well, it's a little bit more. It's a little bit higher than put your server over there.
Okay.
We deal with things, especially with the group. They focus a lot on the application platform, and so they bring me in when they start talking about things like authentication, authorization, Active Directory, MIIS, which is the Microsoft Identity and Integration Server. And all of that sort of thing. So it's a lot of the infrastructure related type of topics. I consider that the foundation that always gets overlooked when you start talking about application platform.
You know, you have a point there. So, all right, you know, you have a good point there, because when you think about people start into building an application, they just immediately go off on, what are the web services look like, and what about the database structure, and how are we going to put together the business logic? And they don't even want to think about this foundation. They just kind of assume that it's there, right? But you're there helping them to build that solid foundation.
That's right.
Okay, excellent. Well, and so here at the North American Architect Forum, you are doing an interesting talk on the challenge of identity. So what's so challenging about identity?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who identify what an identity is, first of all.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like identity stores and all that have grown fairly organically. So, for example, you've got one application that's got all of its usernames and passwords sitting in its own database. So you've got this over here for this application. Then you've got your Active Directory over here. Then you've got your SunEye Planet over here. So we've got all these disconnected identity blobs all over the place. And so from a user's perspective, what happens? The user has to remember this password over here and this username for this particular application. They have to remember the password to log onto their machine. And so one of the things that tends to happen is people start writing their passwords, putting them on their monitor, putting it in that first drawer that they have at their desk. So one of the challenges is security. People are, I mean, if you look at anybody. Let's take, for example, myself, and I'm guilty of this. For all of my personal things, like my banking, my Discover card, and all that sort of thing, what do we tend to do? We type in the same username and same password, and we have that everywhere.
No, say it ain't so. You do this, too?
I do.
Yeah, okay, because we're all guilty. Well, in fact, we're all guilty of that because it's such a pain in the neck.
It is.
And especially as people have gone to insisting on strong passwords, Well, I was just setting up an account, just where was it? Just on some bank site or something the other day. And I have this one password I always use, and it wouldn't take it. It was like, no, you have to have a special character. And I'm going, oh, great. Now I got to add another thing to this and try to remember what that was. And so it's interesting because I had Kim Cameron, who is one of the architects of this whole security thing at Microsoft. He was on the show. And he has a great site, that identityblog.com.
That's a great site. It's one of my favorites.
I love the quote. He has a picture here on the homepage. It says, "Your identity is your most valuable possession. Protect it, and if anything goes wrong, use your powers." That's Elastigirl from the what movie was that? The Incredibles.
Yeah, that's right.
I should know that. Like, my daughter only watches that 100 times a day or something.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it was fun. Anyway, so we have this identity, and the thing is, we're being asked to prove who we are to system after system, and it's hard just to keep up with this in a secure way.
It is, even from an authentication and an authorization perspective, because you've got different identities hanging out there, and yeah, it might be easy enough to prove who you are, but trying to figure out how to store all the things that you can do.
Yeah.
So it's for example, I have a customer that I had been working with that has different stores of identity that they're all trying to glom into one spot.
Uh-huh.
And they've got a lot of challenges with, well, what's going to get fed into there, and it's going to be this big meta directory. And that's where we are, I would say, today, is where our challenge is. Getting all of these disparate systems, and at least just, okay, let's just feed them into one spot. So at least we have one center of knowledge right there of all of our identities. That's great, but it does not leverage all of the features, like, say, for example, of Active Directory and the security in Kerberos and all of the fun stuff that we have with Active Directory for securing, or even using the Sun iPlanet.
Yeah.
And using their strengths. So none of the strengths of the directories are out there are being leveraged. So let them do their job. Instead, they're pulling all these identities in, and one is getting fed here, one's getting fed here, one's getting fed here. So determining what gets fed where. It's very confusing. That their processes around it are very long. That's one of the challenges, I guess.
You know what else is an interesting challenge? I think there's a lot of challenges around this that are purely technical, right? But there are a lot of challenges around this that are kind of people and process based. For example, if we were to say we came out with the ultimate biometric thing. It could absolutely not be fooled anywhere, and in any circumstances, we were going to equip every PC in the world with this so that all you had to do is just come up and everybody would instantly know who's using that computer. People would not want it.
Absolutely not.
But that would, like, totally solve the problem, wouldn't it?
I guess to some extent it would. I'm sure a lot of people have heard about what InfoCard is.
Sure.
And what it does is it puts that power back gives the control right back to the user.
Uh-huh.
So I get to decide what I'm going to project about myself.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to, say, for example, my credit card company, well, they don't really need to know my social security number, do they?
Well, except for they already do.
Well, they do,
yeah.
But I don't need to send that information over every
right,
time
right.
I'm going to get it.
Well, that's actually like my bank's website for a long time. The user ID when you logged in was your social security number. And then they finally got a clue and said, okay, you can use something else if you want to. And then I just noticed the other day they said, after June 1st, we're not taking social security numbers anymore. So they're getting around to it.
Right. Right. Well, I can even remember back in the old days when I was a cashier at my college bookstore. Every time anybody wrote a check, what did we get off of their driver's license? Their social security number. What the heck do you need that in order to cash a check? You don't.
Sure.
So the control has been traditionally out of the user's hands as far as what information they're giving. A lot of it is what Kim calls password fatigue.
Yeah.
And it's very true. I mean, we were talking earlier about this. I use the same password, same username and all that because I'm sick and tired of having to make up something new, or I just simply can't remember it.
You know what I do is I don't actually use like a word or something. I use a pattern on the keyboard. And so I go like, I start here and I go left, right, left, right, left, right, and I go down or over or up, or I do shift, now I had to do an uppercase one, so I go shift left, right, left, right, left, right. I kind of move these patterns around the keyboard, And so if you ask me to write down my password, I don't know what it is. I'd have to actually look at a keyboard and look at the pattern, then I could write it down. It's kind of sad. But it works. It actually works really well for strong passwords because, you know, you can get the special characters in and all that. So.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a challenge that I remember a time when a CIO kicked off a project. And one of the reasons was because he was going to one of his production systems.
Yeah.
He's in the automotive industry. And it's in a separate Active Directory force than what his desktop logon is. Well, he needed to get to it, and he had to type in a completely different username and a completely different password, and he just threw his hands up and said, "This stinks.
Yeah.
You got to fix this. We got to tie these two things together."
Oh, sure.
So a lot of it starts, you know, you start going into, well, is the user going to use it?
Mm-hmm.
We heard in the keynote this morning about, you know, the user experience.
Yeah.
And that is so true when it comes to identity, and that leads us to that holy grail of single sign-on. Give me just one thing that's going to get me everywhere. You know, and some people might say, well, yeah, that's security risk, this, that, and the other. And so there's a lot of things that have to come under the covers, which brings us back to leveraging the strengths of the systems that contain those identities.
Yeah.
So, you know, just seeing all the way up to the top.
Okay, so let's say I'm like that CEO, and I'm really ticked off about this whole situation, and I'm like, we got to fix this. Okay, and you're here as infrastructure advisor, so you're going to give me some advice. So what's your advice? Where do we begin solving that problem?
Oh, that's a tough question. There's so many different ways to do it out there.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to look at that particular situation, I would have to look and see what the two directories are that contain those identities, and then you got to start trying to figure out, well, how do we bring them together?
Yeah.
There's many ways you can do that. I mean, you can use MIIS in the middle so that you can aggregate them, and or you can make one the, like I call it, the center of excellence or the source of truth,
yeah.
And where that one is the only one where it ever gets fed from, and then it gets pushed out to the other ones and provisions it and all that sort of thing. So that's one way of doing it.
Uh-huh.
Off the top of
my head. Really the first thing is to kind of sit down and assess what is the situation like today? What do you got, right? So you'd go, you got this directory and that directory and the others, and then you begin working out the solution from there?
Yes, you do. And then usually what would happen is I've got another customer who says, we want this based on open standards.
Hmm.
So that, you know, let's just throw that on the pot and mix it up a little bit. So that makes it even more challenging. So what is Microsoft doing so that we could support the Suns out there and the IBMs and our stuff at the same time?
Okay, so what standards are involved in this area?
The web services is what Microsoft's vision is of getting identities together.
Uh-huh.
Kim Cameron has a great white paper on the Meta system.
Okay.
And I encourage a lot of people to read that because it's fantastic. It's very true. But it basically says it's the system of systems, and I've said it over and over again in this conversation, is leverage what the other system's strengths are and expose that through web services.
So it's almost like you're saying, hey, look, you know, if you think you're going to get down to just one system, we're going to collapse all these into one system, that's never going to happen.
Never. Never. Heterogeneous infrastructures and architectures are reality.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way that you're ever going to have somebody who is 100% Microsoft. It's just not going to happen. Never going to be anybody who's 100% Sun.
Yeah.
It's because businesses grow organically. I mean, you acquire one company, you let another company go, you bring in another one. I mean, it's just you inherit a whole bunch of different things. So you have to be able to connect these things. So the way that the best analogy that I can have for it is you've got two train cars.
Yeah.
You've got one that's a tanker and you've got one that's a boxcar.
Yeah.
Well, how do you get these two things to talk to each other?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's all about that connector that you have between the two of them. And if you've got that common way of negotiating how you're going to talk and what kind of security you're going to use to talk to each other, then you've got it made. And that's where web services come in.
Now, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned web services, because I think the one standard that most people think of when we talk directories is LDAP.
Exactly.
So are we saying, like, we're done with that, man, we're moving on to something else, or what is LDAP anyway, for those people who don't know?
Well, LDAP is called Lightweight Directory Access Protocol,
mm-hmm.
and it's essentially, it's a directory of objects and a hierarchy of the objects. I mean, it's just like Active Directory. Active Directory is LDAP-based. So you've got a series of objects, and each of those objects has attributes that's associated with it. So For example, we've got a username. Mm-hmm. That's an object, and all the attributes that are associated with it might be your address, your middle name, your phone number, and all that sort of thing. So those are the attributes that are associated with it. Another example of an attribute is you are an expense report approver. Uh-huh. So that's another attribute, even though it could be also considered like an access right or a claim.
Okay,
about yourself.
So an LDAP, I mean, from what little bit I know about it, seems like it defines this sort of data model and a syntax for saying what part of the data model you want to access. Does it go as far as like describing communications protocols and ports and things that you're going to use to talk to an LDAP server, or is that beyond what it does?
Well, there are standard ports for connecting to an LDAP server, and you can do it in a secure way, or you can just do it
know,
clear text. But for the most part, I would consider LDAP just a directory.
Yeah.
It's a directory of things. Same with Active Directory or even Sun iPlanets. I mean, they're all based on the same standard LDAP.
Okay.
So think of that as the directory. Now, if you want to talk about what that next layer is of how to communicate in between the two of them, say, for example, Active Directory and Sun LDAP, you have to find that commonality between the two or write an application with that commonality.
Right.
Where here, I'm telling you what I want to see from you as far as a security perspective. These are the claims that I expect. This is the format I expect them to be in, and I want this kind of certificate when you're talking to me.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got what the calling directory is saying that it will be able to do, so they'll negotiate between the two.
Okay.
And that's what web services does.
Okay. So now, in the past, I assumed that most people kind of did interop between directories with, just kind of TCP/IP stuff, but maybe that's not so interoperable.
Well, TCP/IP is that one. I would liken TCP/IP to, how can I explain it? Kim Cameron gives a good example of how people started talking in a common language across the internet.
Sure.
And TCP/IP was what that was, the internet protocol. So you got people who are doing token ring and Ethernet over here, and you've got all these different methods of Tucker, X25 over here.
Right.
And so what they did is it just said, fine, you guys go ahead and use X25. We're going to use this common language on the top to communicate. So that's what TCP/IP or IP does.
Right. Okay.
So what the notion of web services is the notion of having that common language across the top. Or at least negotiating between what you talk and what you talk.
Okay,
does that make sense?
Yeah. So we're getting to, we got a couple of systems that got their own directories, and they need to be able to talk to each other. But then you have some other problems, which is like, let's say that my password is different in directory A than it is in directory B. Which one is the right password? Or do I want to allow me to have two different passwords? Or how do I resolve those kind of things, right? That's an issue.
That is an issue, and that's one of the biggest issues that's facing everybody today. So what's traditionally done is you have to remember that username and that password that goes with that particular system. So if you want to access that, you have to remember that. The notion of InfoCard is an easier way of looking at it. InfoCard is like your wallet.
Yeah.
You've got your credit cards, you've got your library cards, you've got your driver's license. And you get to choose which one is going to be appropriate for what system's calling it. And what InfoCard would do is, say for example, you're connecting to your library.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to show up your credit card as being a method of accessing the library.
All right.
It's going to expose your library card, and you get to pick.
So the system says, I want a library card. Now I might have three of them, and InfoCard's going to show me the three library cards I have. I have to know which one of those three belongs to that library, right? But the cards are, they can have a nice little logo on them and branded and all that sort of stuff,
yes,
right?
Yes. And that puts the control back in the user's hands of deciding which one they want to do. And they can even get down to the level of exposing what they want about themselves. So, for example, you start bringing in the notion of privacy
mm-hmm.
in there. And if I were exposing out to my library card, okay, I've got my date of birth, well, that's a pretty specific thing about myself.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily need it to be down to that point. I could say I'm between the age of 29 and 33.
Uh-huh.
Instead. So that,
or just maybe I'm over 18.
I'm
or
over
8, like
exactly.
That. Yeah.
And that's a very good example. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what InfoCard will let the user do. It's like, okay, here's my library card, but I get to choose what information's on that library card. It's a negotiated thing between you and that library.
It is kind of funny because, you know, you think about, like, warranty cards, right? You know, you'd buy somebody things, and you know, they want your name and address. Okay, I can understand that. But then they start going, well, how much money do you make? And how many kids do you have? And
it's all like, married? Are you divorced? You know, it's like, what products have you bought in the last 3 months? Yeah, and all that sort of thing. And you know what? And you fill it out, don't you?
No, I don't, actually.
Well, sometimes I fill it out because sometimes, you know, they give you that little care saying, well, yeah, but, you know, if you do this and if you break, you can call us. But
yeah, because they want to say, like, hey, well, we're not going to give you a warranty unless you tell us how many kids you have. Like, that's pathetic.
No, that's garbage.
Actually, I noticed that lately they've kind of softened that up. I think I noticed recently I got one where it said, this is optional information. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I left a blank.
Skip it. Yeah, whenever I see optional, I skip it because I don't want to take the time to fill it out. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, everybody's in the habit of just filling in whatever they ask you for.
Sure.
They do. I mean, I'm guilty of it just as anybody else is because I'm a human being.
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting thought that... as an architect, you might be thinking about the kind of personal information you're asking for and how that impacts the system. So, for example, using the age one in the library. Mm-hmm. Maybe the library has certain books or videos or whatever that they won't rent to somebody that's under 18 or check out to anyway. Let's say it that way. And so you could say, all right, well, if I choose on my info card to say, I'm not going to tell them my age, then they'll say, okay, well, then we're going to have to assume that you're under 18 and we're not going to rent you those things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, that would make a lot of sense.
It would.
But it just introduces a new wrinkle into the kind of the way you think about the information architecture of the data you're going to gather and maybe people are choosing not to tell you everything about themselves.
Right. Well, I mean, you can even liken it to the differences between the way Europe treats privacy and the United States treats privacy.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
There's a lot of people who say, United States, we don't understand privacy at all compared to what Europe does. It even comes down to where I have a customer where, you know, those privacy, those password questions that you type in, you know, the hints, they actually had to get them approved by their European subsidiaries before they could even bring them into their system for common password hints.
Well, you know,
because they couldn't ask for too much information from that person.
I remember seeing several sites, actually, that asked, like, what's your mother's maiden name was one of the password hint questions. And I thought, you know, I remember sometimes banks would ask you that when you call them up to kind of prove your
identity. They still do that.
Yeah, and I thought, well, I don't want to tell them that because then, you know, that would be maybe something they could use. In fact, really, when you think about it, when you call a customer service line, and they're asking you, like, questions like, what's the last four digits of your Social Security and whatever. They're doing the same kind of challenge response thing that we do in the computer system to verify identity.
Right.
And people are very concerned about it. In fact, just this morning, I was watching the local news here in Colorado. Big story comes on. You know, the state attorney general warns you to check your credit card receipts for phony charges. Turns out there was this guy who was going around and paying off, like, you know, people who work at restaurants and stores and saying, like, hey, you know, give me receipts. And so those credit card receipts, you know, they would, like, gather them up and they'd give it to him and he'd pay him, you know, $20, $50 or whatever. And so when they caught the guy, he had, like, hundreds of receipts of credit card numbers and, you know, signatures and whatnot. Pretty amazing. Scary stuff, right?
That's extremely scary stuff. I mean, that makes you want to go and shred all your receipts that you have sitting in your wallet, right?
Well, the sad thing is, I don't think those receipts are really required. I mean, nobody pays attention to them. I noticed that some places now they don't even ask you to sign anymore. But the little dumb signature on that paper, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, you know, I took a trip to Europe about, it was back in November. And the thing that I noticed there that I think would be really cool to have here is whenever you give somebody your credit card, they take it away, and they take it away somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you always assume that, it's safe.
Yeah.
They're just going to run it through the register and give me my check, and I'm going to sign it. Well, how do you know what they're doing with that credit card?
Sure.
They could be running it through that. They could be writing down your number. They could be copying your signature. Those special three numbers you have on the back of your credit card, they have those, too.
Exactly.
So what they do in Paris when we were sitting there eating lunch is we gave them their credit card, and they brought this little portable device over.
Sure.
The credit card never left your site. And so they would run it right there in this little portable machine, and it would print out your receipt, and your credit card never left your site. So what an interesting idea.
Well, you know, this happened to me once in Los Angeles. I took a taxi to the airport. When I got back, some weeks later, I was looking at my credit card bill, and I saw the charge for my taxi ride. But then I saw another charge from the same taxi company, bit different amount, same day. And so I called American Express, and I said, I don't know if this is right, because I'm quite sure I only took one taxi ride that day, and I got on a plane, and I left Los Angeles. So there's no way that I was on any other taxi that day. And so then the taxi company, you know, they, American Express, contact them. They fill out this form, and they send it to me, and they send a copy of a slip. Well, sure enough, there was a slip. They had run, the taxi driver had run two slips when he made mine, and then he just did a bad forgery of my signature when he took the other, did the other slip.
Nobody ever looks at your signature anymore either.
Yeah,
it's very surprising.
Yeah. So anyway, I didn't end up having to pay for it, right. but it's just kind of a weird thing to think, people would do something like that.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, you can't trust anybody these days. Yeah. But, you know, that's why the notion of putting the control back in your hands really comes in, and just exposing what you need to expose in order to get access to services.
Sure, sure.
So that's what the notion of what Kim Cameron's meta system is.
Well, when you think about this very notion of a person wants to make a payment to an institution, and there's a lot of parties involved in this transaction, what you'd like to do is you'd like to keep the crucial bits of information opaque to the people who don't need to know, like the taxi driver or the person at the store who's going to sell the receipt to the bad guy out the back door, you know, after the shift. You know, I mean, all of those, we don't want those people to know anything about this. They don't have to know, right? They just need to, they're involved in the transaction some way. They only need to know minimally what they have to know.
Right.
And unfortunately, the system we have now is way too open. But, you know, people are paying the price.
Yeah.
I mean, well, not so much people, but the credit card companies are, and at least they're making lots of money, and they don't care, so they're just leaving it go.
Well, they are, but you can't take out the fact that they might be concerned about it, because they spend enormous amounts of money on fraud prevention.
Well, that's true. And I did notice that, like, the other day I went to pump gas, and I put my credit card in, and it asked me for the billing zip code of my credit card, right? Which is a simple thing to do, but if it was a stolen card, I might not know.
Right.
You know, so that was a good
right.
measure.
Right, and one thing that I've noticed a lot of other retailers are beginning to do is they're starting to ask what your phone number is when they run your credit card. Like, hey, what's your phone number? And you're thinking, why do you want my phone number? Oh, great, now I'm on a telemarketer list because you've sold my phone number.
Yeah.
And I actually challenged one of them about that. I said, why do you need to know my phone number? And she said, it's because this is how we verify that the credit card is really you.
Ah.
Well, that could have just been some malarkey
excuse
that she was told to say because, you know, how do I know that their point of sale system is connected back up to my credit card and that it's going to sit and try to expose those things, you know, between the two? It was very doubtful.
Yeah.
So it might have been a likely story, but it's very much like your zip code challenge.
Yeah,
you know, so it's kind of like, are you really who you are?
Okay, so if we're going to overcome these challenges, it seems like you're going to have a plan, a strategy in place, kind of at an enterprise level, because I think in these directories that kind of grow up out of anything, right? Or you go off and buy a new enterprise software package, and they got their own directory thing, and you know, so there's you have to have some kind of enterprise strategy, don't you?
Absolutely, you do. And one of the challenges that I faced with a customer very recently was they have a global strategy for their corporate identities. Well, then now they've got these disparate plants that they have. It's a manufacturing company. And each of their plants is their own Active Directory force. And they do that for a very, very logical and very valid reasons, because some of the plants are in very highly risky security areas, like, say, for example, in the Middle East. So they want to keep them separate, but they also want to keep them isolated for if anything were to happen in corporate, they wouldn't ever want that to take down a production line, because we all know that costs, you know, it could potentially cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a minute.
Oh, yeah.
So trying to tie what the global strategy was in with the special needs of what the manufacturing plants had was an enormous challenge, because they did not want to open that door up to the plant. They essentially was, I do not trust corporate. And so it was like butting heads and trying to, well, can you just open the door just a little bit?
Sure.
You know, well, we still want all these functionalities over here, but we want it to be so tightly secured you know, it's almost like, well, then fine, you're going to do a denial of service on yourself. You know, so, but it was, you know, all of the challenges that they faced were extremely valid, and we finally did eventually, you know, convince them enough to say, you can open the door if we do this. And so we're starting to look at potentially using MIIS between the two. And so tying MIIS into their enterprise strategy, which included the plants as well.
Okay, so I think a lot of people have never heard of MIIS.
Okay.
Which actually kind of, every time someone says that, I think of, oh, miss.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of unfortunate. But I had never heard of it, actually, until I sat on a bus at a tech ed across from one of the program managers from the team, you know, and I was like, what product do you work on? And I never heard of it. What is that product and what does it do?
What it does is I call it like, it's got the notion of the metaverse.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be either the aggregator, it could be the provisioner. What it does is it ties all of those disparate systems, your HR system, your financial systems, Active Directories, Sun LDAP directory. It could tie all those things together and have it basically, when a new user is created, someone, we'll take a provisioning strategy first, okay? If you got a new user comes in, he comes in, you know, an HR types that user in, that is all his personal information, all that. Well, he needs an email account. He needs a desktop logon, and since he's in accounting, he's going to need access to the financial system too.
Yeah.
Well, in a company that I used to work for, traditionally what happened was an email was sent by the HR person saying, okay, this person's set up in our system. He's in HR now. Go do your thing.
Yeah.
So what would happen? We had an entire staff of people just to provision a username and an email account.
Wow.
So, I mean, there were like three or four people who, that's all they did all day long was that. And so how do you get that information back out to that person? So, you know, next thing you know, it's like 3 days later, and they're giving out, well, here's your email address, here's your user account, and here's your temporary password.
Yeah.
They email it to that person's administrator, you know, or secretary, and then they give them their username.
Or what's worse is when somebody is fired, and then it takes 2 or 3 days for their accounts to get shut down.
Right. How do you manage that identity life cycle? And so what MIS does is it helps you manage that. So when in HR that user gets fired, HR says this person is fired, it'll go into MIS. I'm going to say, oh, okay, well, this person needs to be removed. So they remove them from Active Directory, they remove them from the financial system, and they remove them from whatever systems that they might have access to.
Get them out of there before they transfer $1 million to their personal account.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You get that disgruntled administrator, right? You know, it's like, I'm going to change all the administrator passwords, you know, and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, you're right. It's so that's one of the biggest uses for MIS that I see.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. It just seems to me that you know, I never really knew about that before I came to Microsoft. So it's like, why wasn't that marketed harder? Because it seems like that's one of the biggest pains that's out there.
Well, it looks like a good opportunity for cost saving, too, because you got people doing this work that could be automated, mm-hmm. and you know, you can put those people on something more important.
Absolutely. Or you can even save money. I mean, this is always a bad word, but, you know, I mean, if they're not needed anymore, then you can redirect the funds from what they're doing to something else where it might be needed.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I hate to say, you know, we'll just fire those people because they're not needed anymore, but that is the reality.
Well, or maybe if you're like most IT groups I've seen, they've got like 100 other things that they could be doing, and you know, they weren't doing them because this was so vital, this function that it had to get done. So now maybe you can put them on something else that needs to get done.
Absolutely. That, and plus, you know, they're always working with, well, we've got a 20% cut in our budget this year, so we have to run lean. That's every year. But, yeah, so they're always looking for a way to prioritize, and maybe they can get more important things done.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Beth, for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to have been here.
All right.
Thanks.
Beth Patton, ladies and gentlemen. The challenges of identity. Wasn't that fun? Wow. Just love getting out and meeting with folks and hearing from you. I've heard from so many on email as well. In fact, here's a nice note from Julio, who writes, "Hi, Ron. First of all, I'd like to thank you for being such a great host on your Channel 9 podcast series. I have to tell you how important your work is for me. I'm Cuban. I can't travel easily, and because of your podcast, I have had the big opportunity of attending so many conferences and events. That's an opportunity I never considered as possible. So thank you again, and congratulations on a job excellently done." Wow, thanks, Julio. I'm just delighted that we can bring you events like this, and we'll keep doing it. here from Vail, Colorado. We'll see you next time on ArtCast.